Welcome back, podcast listeners. This is Dr. Rewat Dhiyanandan, global health epidemiologist. Today's episode is a bit of a departure. We are featuring a special assignment by students from my fourth year international health class from 2015. So the first one will be by Matthew Dawkins and Amal Gill, who are doing a little bit of something outside the box. They are pretending to be experts. Amal interviews Matthew, who pretends to be Maxwell Lord, a supposed expert on Ebola and global health. And what they're going to talk about is Ebola, everyone's favorite hemorrhagic fever. And the paper that they're going to analyze is called Clinical Features of Patients Isolated for Suspected Ebola Virus Disease at Connaught Hospital of Freetown, a Retrospective Cohort Study, which is available at The Lancet, and we will link to it at the website. So go to dhiyanandan.com, click on podcast, select the Dhiyanandia podcast, and get the right episode. So without further delay, here are Matthew and Amal doing their thing.
Hello and welcome to another episode of HealthCast. My name is Amol Gill, and boy do we have an interesting show for you today. As you all know, back in 2014, Ebola, or the Ebola Zaire virus as it is known in the scientific community, re-emerged in the war-stricken and low-income country of Sierra Leone, Africa. There have been many efforts to try and understand things like symptoms, treatment, and containment of the Ebola virus. To get a better understanding of all that and more, we have someone very well known in the field of international and global health, Dr. Maxwell Lord, who is an epidemiologist. He works with large organizations such as the WHO or the World Health Organization to understand various elements and conditions around illnesses. So we will discuss with him some of the intricacies of an article available at www.thelancet.com titled Clinical Features of Patients Isolated for Suspected Ebola Virus Disease at Connaught Hospital, Freetown, Sierra Leone, a Retrospective Cohort Study. So without any further ado, Dr. Lord, first of all, welcome to the show, and I would like to thank you for taking time out of your day to come and speak with us today.
Thanks for having me, Mal.
No worries. So now, Doctor, let's talk about Ebola. Now, before we actually, begin to appraise this article and dig at it, for those who may not know of the details of this condition, would you be able to give us a quick summary?
Sure thing, Amal. Now, this data is taken from the WHO fact sheet on Ebola that was published in 2015. I'd say that the first thing is important to know is that Ebola is a zoonotic condition, which means that it did spread to humans through contact with animals. In this case, Ebola's natural host, I would say, is the fruit bat. Now, Ebola has a clinical incubation period, so you're not going to be able to see symptoms from anywhere between 2 and 21 days. Now, this can be very problematic, as people can be infected and infecting their loved ones without them even knowing. Now, Ebola is actually quite a clinically deadly disease. It expresses itself via hemorrhagic fever, and basically what it does is it will attack your body, attacks your organs, your blood vessels, your body's ability to regulate itself, and it does have a very high fatality rate, approaching 70% in the most recent outbreak, which is actually more deadly than malaria and TB and HIV when it's been treated. Now, the only way to confirm that someone has contacted Ebola is through a test called the Ebola virus reverse transcriptase polymerase chain reaction. Now, it's very much a mouthful. And the unfortunate thing is that there is no truly great treatment for Ebola. When someone has actually tested positive for this condition, what is done is that they're given fluids, they're given IV, and they're treated for any other complications that may arrive while they're infected. But we still, at this point, have no really great way to treat this. And what's one last thing is that historically, cases of Ebola have tended to be limited geographically to sub-Saharan Africa. And this was very much the same with the most recent outbreak, although there were isolated cases in some European and North American countries, such as the United States, the UK, Italy, and Spain.
Okay, great. So that should clear it up for anybody who is not sure of the details of Ebola. So now the article I found here is actually one that you assisted on yourself, so that's pretty cool. This article is extremely interesting, and the reason for that is pretty simple, and that is that diagnosis is extremely tough. There are a lot of symptoms that are shared by other common conditions, such as HIV, and actually honing in on one disease could be pretty difficult, as you and the rest of the world know for sure. So Sierra Leone was fully ravished with the 2014 outbreak of Ebola. Because of this, the amount of beds available at hospitals had severely diminished, and it became imperative for healthcare workers in that area to try to find a way to understand who actually needed the beds versus those who didn't. So, Doctor, we'll go straight to you and ask you, what were the methods that you used to get your information for the study?
So our study was a retrospective cohort study. So what we did was a period of time from March 31st to October 24th, 2014, was that we gathered information on patient symptoms from everyone who was sent to the Connaught Hospital in Freetown suspected of having Ebola. And so we sampled a total of 850 individuals, of which 464, or 64%, tested positive for Ebola. Now, what our results found was that some of the biggest indicators of disease were fever with 83%, and that this is no surprise as the WHO method of detecting Ebola does tend to rely on the individual expressing a fever or having a fever. We also found intense fatigue in 68% of people, vomiting in 50% of people, diarrhea in 41%, as well as anorexia in about 37%, and abdominal pain in 33%. Now, using these results, we came up with our own screening tool to help to quickly identify those with Ebola. And what we found was that our tool had a sensitivity of about 90%, which actually means it was more effective than the WHO definition, which only captured about 80% of those who were infected with Ebola.
Okay, so you mentioned the word sensitivity. I'm pretty sure that a lot of our viewers and listeners won't really know what that is. Their version of sensitivity is probably somebody who's too emotional. So in terms of science and epidemiology, how would you define sensitivity?
So basically how we sensitivity is described in the field of epidemiology is basically how many people infected with the disease can your screening tool catch? So say for our tool, which has sensitivity of about 90.7%, which means that if 100 people came into the hospital infected with Ebola, using our screening method, we would realistically be able to identify about 90 to 91 of these individuals. And what was really interesting, as I already previously mentioned, was that the tool that we came up with was actually more sensitive and caught more people infected with Ebola than the WHO definition, which tended to rely on a diagnosis of fever. What we found was that in as much as 10% of cases, individuals with Ebola did not actually present a fever. They didn't have this condition that was so vital in order to catch it with the WHO screening tool.
Okay, great. Thank you so much for that. So now as someone who, you know, has been a part of this project and has been in the field of epidemiology and science doing research all these years, you among, you know, all other people, or most other people, would agree that most research initiatives are not perfect. So what would you consider some of your positives and negatives for this study?
So what I find with retrospective cohort studies is that they're really good in the field of international and global health. They're really cheap and easy because for our paper, we did not require any additional funding to make this screening tool. And what I also find is that they're able to be really practical because within 6 months of gathering this data, we were able to actually operationalize and create our own screening tool. What I also found was, I was really good with this study, was that we were able to get a sample of literally every individual who was suspected of having Ebola, which means that our sample was very encompassing for the, not only Freetown, but the area around it as well. And what I also found was that we were able to use a high level of statistical analysis of these types of studies. We were able to calculate sensitivity, specificity, positive and negative predictor values, as well as the odds ratio for each and every clinical characteristic that we studied. Now, that does not mean that the research was not without its downfalls, or its disadvantages, I'd say. Well, the biggest issue that we were having throughout this study was actually gathering good data. Because we relied on the local health workers who were overworked, they were busy, incredibly stressed, and not quite trained to the same educational level as North American or European workers, was that they did not necessarily gather good or complete data, as well as the fact that we had to rely on the patient's history, which especially when they're presenting confusion, made it very difficult to gather this information, as well as made it very susceptible to recall bias, as some people may forget certain symptoms they experience, misremember, or even lie for their own personal reasons. And the last thing we had was that this really did affect our true sample size, because of the 464 positive cases, we were only actually able to use data on about 292 of them, because there was basically holes or gaps or incomplete data about the other ones, which does limit some of the clinical uselessness and rigor of the data we collected.
Okay, great. So now I know that you mentioned that the study was really just an analysis on how to better screen, how to better, you know, acquire information and data on certain conditions. In this one, this study here, specifically Ebola. But what I want to know is, were there any sort of measures that allowed you to increase educational efforts to maybe inform the people in the area on, you know, preventative measures, things they could avoid, certain ways or certain diets, maybe something like that, that they could partake in to avoid getting Ebola?
Well, I do believe that education would be a great next step for our program. It really wasn't in the scope of what we were trying to accomplish. What we were doing was solely basically disease surveillance and attempting to develop a better screening tool. But we did actually, once this tool was developed, we did inform locals and those involved around the Freetown Hospital how to correctly use this screening. So while there was a bit of an educational component, it really wasn't the core of what we're trying to do or the core of this initiative.
Okay, I understand. So now let me just ask you this. Would you consider, you know, the complete lack of education or educational efforts to be a con of the study? Why or why not, would you say?
Well, I wouldn't necessarily consider that to negatively affect the data that we received or the validity of our screening tool, but I would consider it to be sort of just unfortunate because we really would have liked to educate individuals and educate workers, but as I previously mentioned, it just wasn't within the scope or the funding of what we're able to do. But that is actually, it's a really good next step, and that is what we're sort of trying to hope to do with this information. Because by developing a better screening tool and by informing and educating people how to properly use it, I think it really could help spread the curve of disease in the future in case there ever is another Ebola outbreak.
That's what I was wondering, just because I know that education when it comes to conditions and diseases, we've seen it here in Canada and in other, you know, Western countries, that education really helps to curb the progression of conditions. So that is wonderful to know. Now, this may be completely self-explanatory and, you know, pretty obvious, but just to clear it up and just to clear up any confusion, what would you say is the actual need of this population that you spent around 6 to 7 months with doing surveillance?
I would say the issues facing Sierra Leone are really similar to the issues facing the rest of sub-Saharan Africa. Things like poor health systems, lack of infrastructure, lack of hygiene, lack of food security, that's the most basic things are needed in this region. And in data from the UN Development Program from 2013, Sierra Leone rated 193 out of 207 on the Human Development Index, and has a life expectancy of only 47.5 years, which means that even among underdeveloped nations, Sierra Leone is probably one of the worst off in the world, and actually has one of the highest under 5 mortality rates in the entire world. But talking more about the Ebola and the recent Ebola crisis, while this was a major issue during the time of the study, what's been found recently was that the outbreak is really starting to reside. In the most recent risk assessment report from the European Center of Disease Control, there actually hasn't been a new reported case of Ebola since mid-September. But what this outbreak has shown us in both how wide-reaching it was and the amount of deaths it was that outbreaks can occur at any point in time, especially when we least expect it, and especially in cases with very poorly developed health infrastructure and disease surveillance. So while it may not be a massive issue now as the outbreak starts to recede, it doesn't mean that Ebola might not become, that there might not be another outbreak of Ebola and for it to become an immediate need in the near future.
Okay, that's pretty interesting. So now you mentioned a term called HDI. Now for most of us, including myself, probably don't know what that means. And I'm assuming that, you know, it has a pretty big impact on this actual topic. So now with us today, we have Dr. Jared Kirsch, who is currently working with different NGOs to establish programs that work towards encouraging economic growth in small communities that focus around agriculture. So welcome to the show, Dr. Kirsch, and thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, thank you. My pleasure.
All right. So like I mentioned before, I have no idea what the HDI means. I almost thought it was quality for a television screen or something, but I'm not sure what it means, and I'm pretty sure that most people also feel the same way. So, Dr. Kirsch, how would you define it for, you know, the layperson, the everyday person, and how would you say that a disease such as Ebola affects the HDI of a nation?
Okay, so the HDI, or the Human Development Index, allows you to measure the progress or the development of a nation through three main components: income, education, and life expectancy. So to answer the second part of your question there, Ebola would affect all three of those components, but the advantage of the HDI is that it is a system that weighs the components so that if a tragedy or an event occurs that causes fluctuation in one component, the other components will adjust accordingly. Now, essentially, the Ebola crisis would stop income production because people would not be allowed to go to work or be too sick to go to work. Education would obviously come to a stop because children and school-goer students would not be allowed to attend school in public places with fear of continued contamination. And life expectancy would greatly decrease, obviously, because of very high chance that, if you get Ebola, you will die. Thank you, Dr. Kirsch, for that explanation. That was really informative. Thank you so much. So, Dr. Lord, we'll go back to you. Now, you are someone who works very closely with WHO, the World Health Organization, like I mentioned before. And, the WHO is very well known worldwide for redefining what we think of as health, quote-unquote health. And it has become pretty evident that health is simply not, biology. It's not just the medical or the physical aspect. It involves a lot more and creates a larger interdisciplinary definition of health. So in what way would you explain the interdisciplinary conditions of today's topic?
I'm glad you brought that up, Amal, because in today's world, health is increasingly starting to overlap and encompass a multitude of different fields, including sociology, global health, and even epidemiology, and that's just scratching the surface. So what I find specifically with our research was that there's a huge overlap with epidemiology, specifically because this was a disease outbreak, and epidemiology does concern itself with disease control and surveillance. And what I believed is, while gathering some background information from my research, was that the lack of disease surveillance capabilities, as well as disease control, really aided in the spread of this disease. The WHO publicly stated in November 2014 that deaths are likely underreported, which means that there's a lack of informational transfer, that there's a lack of surveillance and control, and this probably did translate into why the disease spread so quickly and affected so many individuals in this region. And this also does tie into global health and development, because it was a lack of infrastructure, development, and education which helped to facilitate the spread of disease. A lot of hospitals did have to close because they were just unable to keep up, or they just didn't have the resources to deal with these Ebola cases, and that probably did lead to negative health outcomes for a multitude of individuals, as well as the fact that they didn't have the education to properly identify and treat these individuals was probably a major reason why we saw so many healthcare professionals becoming infected with this disease.
I actually have one question that I noticed something pretty interesting in the article. Now, this is something that we here in the Western world don't really consider, just because when we do, if there's a funeral for a family member or something like that, it is the funeral home that deals with everything. We don't have to deal with anything at all. And what I read in the article was that a major contributor to Ebola, or a major risk factor for Ebola, was actually the participation in funeral practices. If you could elaborate on that and maybe explain why that would be, one of the risk factors.
Actually, it's really good you brought that up too as well, because in Guinea is where we're seeing a lot of this. Part of their burial and funeral practices involve direct contact with the dead body, including washing it, kissing it, handling it. And what was found was that the amount of Ebola virus in your system increases all the way up to your death. So these individuals were highly contagious, highly infected, and these funeral practices were what we believe was responsible for as much as 2/3 of the Ebola case in Guinea.
Wow.
Yeah, okay. So this cultural practice had an immense effect on the spread of this disease, and that is why the WHO did attempt to implement what was called safe burials. So how that would work was that there would be WHO representatives in full body gear, and what they do is that they'd go around this funeral, they'd help to disinfect the bodies, as well as the individuals. So it was sort of a middle ground between helping to mitigate some of the damages of these cultural practices, while also allowing us to remain culturally sensitive. Because obviously, due to their customs, their practices, their religion, their beliefs, these practices are very important to them as individuals. And I do think that this safe burial program implemented by the WHO was able to remain culturally sensitive towards their needs, while also helping to curb the spread of Ebola.
Okay, so now, I don't know how much you may have seen in terms of, the safe burials that the WHO put into place, but were there any downsides, or, were people not responsive to the actual efforts by the WHO when it comes to safe burials?
I think at first there was a lot of initial hesitation, because obviously funerals and burials are very sacred within cultures. And I think that there is obviously some distrust in the area regarding Western practices, Western medicine, because obviously there was some scandals with the USAID using a false vaccination
effort. Right. Yeah, that's how they got Osama.
That's how they got Osama.
Yeah. Okay.
Go Obama. But I think that after we show them that we could be culturally appropriate and we help to educate them as to the necessity of why we're there, I think they really did start to turn around, and I think that it really did make a positive impact on the area.
Okay, great. So now one last thing just about the cultural practices. I did have a question about DOTS. So for those who do not know, DOTS is better known as the Direct Observed Treatment Short Course. This is something that is seen in countries where TB or tuberculosis, runs rampant. And basically what the system is that they have certain people on bikes or motorcycles or certain, automotive methods of transportation. And they bring TB medication as well as food. And they watch you consume the food. They watch you consume the medication to ensure that you've taken your daily dose. And then they go back. Now, these places are usually isolated from the rest of the community and society. And I was just wondering, Doctor, how you would compare that society to the society we have here in the Western world, where it is almost required that if you have a condition, you go out yourself and take the initiative to seek help.
Well, what I find is here is that we as individuals in our society are really expected to take individual responsibility for our health. We sort of do adopt this sick role where we take time off work, we go seek the doctor, we follow the doctor's instructions to the letter. And I think what the difference between us and their culture is that we're not necessarily socially isolated or excluded, because in Guinea and in Sierra Leone, once individuals are identified within their community as having Ebola, they're quarantined, they're socially isolated, and they're ostracized. And I really do think a program like DOTS does help to mitigate this. It does show that just because they have Ebola doesn't necessarily mean that these individuals are to be feared, are to be isolated.
Okay, wonderful. So now, if I were to ask you, are there any other implications, any other wider implications that you see on a larger scale? What would those be?
Well, I think we have already touched on some of the wider implications. Obviously, we've touched on the need for the development of their healthcare system, including disease surveillance control, to further limit the spread of infection if there is outbreaks of not only Ebola, but really any infectious disease outbreak in the future. And I do think we've already talked about some of the sociological implications, as there still is a bit of a distrust as Western medicine. So what I think sort of comes out of that is that instead of necessarily doing a Western approach using Western individuals, a better approach might be to use locals on the ground. And I think that by developing things such as screening tool and investing in educational and training opportunities for these individuals, we can not only strengthen their healthcare, but we can also make sure that things are culturally appropriate. As I think even you and me, we'd be more willing to trust someone that we know, that we love, that we care about, as opposed to a stranger who lives half a world away.
For sure. So now just to, end off this discussion here quickly, other than the implications that you just talked about, which are, as you said, pretty obvious, we've mentioned them before, are there any larger ways that this article and the situation fit into the larger puzzle of global health?
Well, I think it does fit most obviously to the avalanche of health research regarding Ebola, of the discussions regarding Ebola, given its more recent outbreak. But I think that there is some more subtle ways that it fits into the global health discussion. First and foremost, I think that what this outbreak shows is that infectious disease are going to have a major resurgence in the discussion of global health. As there is an increase in drug-resistant TB, as the world becomes more connected and globalized, I think we're going to see more and more outbreaks, as well as the resurgence of infectious diseases even in more industrialized nations in North America and in Europe. And it'll become more of a major cause of death in these areas.
Okay, so that definitely 100% true about those things. Now, another thing I read was, I personally don't understand it, but the difference between vertical programming and horizontal programming. I kind of got the gist of it, but I would much rather hear a definition from the scientist.
Well, I'd say for vertical programming, the main thing is that the money is targeted towards a very specific issue, such as emerging or a global health crisis, such as Ebola, and it really is effective in these types of situations. While horizontal programming is more investing in the infrastructure, it's more sort of spread around within existing healthcare structures. It can be used from anything from educating workers to building testing facilities to towards research, that type of thing. And what horizontal does is it sort of helps to build and reinforce what's already there, but it doesn't necessarily mean that it would be effective in areas where the infrastructure is so poor or in emergency situations such as the Ebola outbreak. The main issue I have with vertical programs is that it doesn't necessarily help to deal with the follow-up, and it doesn't help to rebuild a country after a health event like this. Sierra Leone's healthcare system is going to be incredibly damaged by this because of the multitude of deaths of not only healthcare workers, but of individuals in the community, the lack of education, the disruption of the economy. It's really going to have a negative impact on the standard of living and the infrastructure that it already has. What I'd like to see more is, like, after events like this, is more investment from the global community in helping to rebuild this country. Because I really do doubt that there is going to be a surplus of funds available to really help to build a, you know, modern functioning healthcare systems. And what I think is really going to happen is that their current system is going to be even more damaged, and it's going to be even more susceptible to events like this if they reoccur. And they might not necessarily be ready to properly deal with any other events.
Okay, great. So, and actually that's one thing that I did want to mention that we talked about before is the whole education aspect of it, to, you know, educate people to understand disease, and that way they'll be able to better prevent contamination. So, Dr. Lord, that is all the time we have today. I thank you so much for your time. I really do appreciate it. And I hope our viewers and listeners learned something new. This is Amol Gill signing off. And until next time, with a fresh new topic and a new professional to talk to, thank you so much and have a great night.